You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Veterans Day. We've got a great show for you this morning. Dubner's in the house. You know, God knows what that's going to mean, but we'll be talking to him later on. But we begin with more numbers, though. The U.S. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve are bailing out the insurance giant AIG once again. It was announced yesterday AIG will receive another $40 billion. And this time the Treasury Department announced it's getting directly involved, buying preferred stock in the AIG company. That would bring their rescue package to nearly $150 billion. To help us explain, first of all, what's in the numbers, and secondly, why AIG seems to be in the front of the line every week, is Mary Williams Walsh, financial reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Mary Williams Walsh, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
So first of all, why once more is AIG up at the bar here?
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing situation. They insured bonds, basically, a very, very complicated type of bond. It's called a CDO. And they insured them not with normal insurance policies like you and I would buy on our house or on our car, but with derivatives. And the derivatives basically just, it's not regulated the way insurance normally would be. And so they sold a huge, huge book of business without really the kind of oversight that you would expect that would keep an insurance company from getting in over its head.
And the derivatives are basically worthless, so the government is coming in to buy them. You know, it occurs to me, what is AIG's business right now? I mean, what is it that they are selling today?
It's a huge conglomerate, really, and they have inside of the holding company, they've got lots of normal insurance companies that you never even would hear about,
right.
You know, that just insure normal things like businesses and life insurance and things like that. They also have money management. I mean, normal financial functions that you can find all over the place. And then this one unit did the derivatives, and that's sort of where all the problems are.
And that's the giant cash bleed. So how is this not people who hold obligations and contracts to pay AIG? How is this not them just saying, oh, hey, the government's in here. I don't have to pay AIG anymore. I'm just going to default on my little obligations to AIG. And so, therefore, AIG reports that as, oh, gosh, more losses. And the Federal Treasury has to basically pay.
Something like that is sort of going on. Underneath these bonds are housing debts.
I thought you were going to say that.
Credit card debts, you know, it's just insuring very, very complicated packages of different kinds of debts. And a lot of debts really are defaulting now.
And so you can basically say, you know, I don't have to pay AIG. The Fed's going to pay, right? I mean, there's no incentive for you to pay AIG anything, correct?
Well, I don't think anybody even is thinking that they're paying AIG. They are paying their mortgage or not paying their mortgage or whatever happens to be inside one of these complicated bonds.
I just wanted to clear that up, Adora.
Mary, in your reporting, you have a quote from one of the assistant secretaries to the Treasury saying that the move was necessary to maintain the stability of the financial system. How do they measure that? What happened, and why is this second wave necessary now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, I mean, there isn't any doubt that AIG is so woven into the financial system. It does business with other financial institutions. And if you have something, you can get a situation going where there's something like a bank run going on at a very high level. And if AIG gets into trouble, it will get many, many other financial institutions into trouble as well. And so they're trying to keep that from happening. It's really, I think, more of an art than a science, figuring out, like, where do you have this systemic risk and where would it be safe to let an institution fail? But basically, AIG is so big that if it failed, it would do a lot of damage to the whole financial system.
And just to follow up on that, you report that much of the original $85 billion line of credit from the Fed has been spent fulfilling collateral calls. Who's getting the money?
Well, we don't exactly know who is. We know it's their trading partners, their insurance customers that bought this special insurance on the bonds that they hold. But AIG has never had to provide a list of the names of who its counterparties are or exactly what their exposure is. So they're getting the money, but we don't know who they are.
Mary, that's the crazy part. I mean, you have a great source in your article who says that we are bailing people out on the other side of the derivatives. So there's basically a bunch of people who are getting money, who are getting made good on some bad investments. We're probably never going to know who they are. And the idea that we're bailing out AIG is just fundamentally a fiction. I mean, is that what you're reporting this morning?
It's not really a fiction. It's that the whole system is so woven together that the reason you have to bail out AIG, I guess, is Because if you don't, all of these other financial institutions that are its customers also would get into trouble, and they would have losses too. And at some point, the system just can't bear that anymore.
Well, I love that you describe it as more of an art than a science. You know, art, I'm thinking Jackson Pollock. I'm definitely not thinking, you know, Seurat or Manet
Matisse. Someone. Yeah.
Mary Williams Walsh, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mary Williams Walsh is a financial reporter for the New York Times. Here in the studio with us is our good friend, Stephen Dubner, who it occurs to me to ask, as the author of the Freakonomics blog, I mean,
Freakonomics.
Who are we bailing out here at AIG?
I have no idea. She doesn't know. How am I supposed to know? No.
But I mean, that's sort of the myth of the bailout, is you're bailing out a company, but you're also bailing out the people who invested in the company, and those are the unknowns.
Of course, but don't forget, a big piece of the bailout, a big reason for the bailout was really to send a signal, right? So if you talk about, economists love to talk about signaling mechanisms, the things that we do to get people to think a certain way, even if that way of thinking is not really where they need to be thinking at the moment. And the bailout was a big signal that the government had reached into its pocket to try to fix the problem that was cratering around us, okay? So the bailout as it now exists and the plan for the bailout, also don't forget that the people writing the checks are going to change in a little while. That to me is the interesting tension right here. So you've got Obama right now assembling a very different kind of economic team than Bush's head. So you know, we're in a state of bizarre. It's like purgatory where you can still get beat up.
Yeah, but before we even get to the Obama administration, it would be nice to know how this bailout package and all of these additional monies, what's happening to them since Congress passed that bailout plan. And I thought a critical component of this was some level of transparency and oversight.
Well, you might think so, but don't forget the first big objection to the bailout was lack of transparency. Don't forget the short memo that Paulson wrote in the first place. I need the money. I need to be able to do with the money what I need to do
but
with the money.
That turned out to be hundreds of pages of a bill that was actually passed.
It did, with still super light on the transparency. That's, you know, it's I'm neither here to defend it nor to cry it. I'm just saying that's what it is. So I don't think we can afford, honestly, to be surprised by this kind of thing. Look what's happening right now with GM. We're seeing the tension, the piece in this morning's Times, which was really interesting, about the Obama-Bush split on what to do with GM and where that money should come from. We're going to see a lot of fistfights even in the next couple months because it's an extraordinary time.
But I guess the question really is who are we bailing? Not so much who gets the money, but there's so many moving parts for this bailout that we actually don't even see. You know, forget transparency. I mean, there's trillions of dollars that Bloomberg has tried to subpoena to figure out where that went. It apparently went to some banks. There's a tax regulation that, like, magically changed in the hours before the bailout was passed that suddenly allows corporations to maybe get a cash refund if they can report enough losses.
It's the problem with building a complicated food chain. I sometimes think of the actual mortgage meltdown as the equivalent of a restaurant. You establish a restaurant in an airport where the traffic is only outgoing, okay? So your customers can never return. And if that's the way it is, then you have no incentive to not feed them the cheapest, most vile food that can make them sick, because once they get they're off your property.
That's way too complicated. No. It's a giant swimming pool of money, and everyone has shovels. It's simple, very simple. I want some. We'll give my friend some. Period. The end.
Yeah, but there's no accountability at your level of doing the transaction. That's the problem.
Well, then isn't this where moral hazard comes in?
Sure.
Right. When there's no sense of there being a consequence for the decisions that you make, people just barrel forward.
Well, moral hazard is even worse than what I'm describing, because moral hazard means you know that you will, that even if you screw up and even if the people down the food chain suffer as a result of you, you will still get not only not punished but perhaps compensated. Right.
Let's bring it back to your signaling mechanism. I mean, it sounds like this is a kind of a dirty signal. It's not a clear signal.
Absolutely. When did anyone become a believer that the federal government operates with a scalpel? Never has, never will, right? So the things that we historically admire, I think you're going to talk about this later in the show, the building the federal highway system, which came about in a weird way, right? It was kind of a military move in the first place. It benefited people who maybe shouldn't have been so much benefited, the automobile industry, at the expense of the railroad industry. These are big, big moves that, in retrospect, we might like.
We're stumbling around. Quick question. Is there a silver lining to this?
Oh, yeah. I got your silver lining right here.
All right. Let's talk silver lining. planning when we come back. With us is Freakonomics blog author, co-author, Stephen Dubner. He's in the studio with us talking about silver linings to this economic meltdown. I don't believe there is one, but he says there is.
I believe you,
I
Stephen.
Thank you.
I do.
Femi, you know, you believe me?
The restaurant where people can't return to their... What is he even talking about?
I think restaurant. You lost me there,
one-way
Stephen,
restaurant.
But I'm with you on the silver lining.
I appreciate it.
Bennigan's. Sounds like Bennigan's. That's a one-way restaurant. Go right to the hospital.
Economics.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.